Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Maybach, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Reddy, but my friends call me Spanner. So, let's be friends. Today, we are going to nerd out on F1 broadcasting. But firstly, didn't little Chris do a great job talking to Nico Hülkenberg's trainer? If you missed that, go and check out the show notes. We'll make sure we link back to that. A really interesting delve into the world of being a personal PT and basically PA to an actual F1 driver. But today we're going to nerd out on broadcasting. We're going to take a deep dive into the way we see, the vast majority of us, see the vast majority of motorsport through a square box in our living room. But we are an independent podcast produced in the podcasting shed with the kind permission of our better halves. We aim to bring you a race review before your Monday morning commute. We might be wrong, but we're first. We're talking about video, so who better to have on than our video producer, Uncle Steve, Steve Amy. Hello, Steve.
Hi there. I'm looking forward to this. It should be an interesting dive into the history of Formula One broadcasting.
Now, what people might not realise is you're not just a grumpy Australian. You do also do so much of the video work here on Missed Apex Podcast. These beautifully designed sets, Steve, are all your work, and you have spent the last 6 years badgering me about video editing, video process, and the panel. You're the Brad Philpott of the video side.
Except I'm not a vegetarian.
No, and Brad only eats fruit that has fallen naturally on the ground. A lot of people don't realise that about Brad. But it's been really similar to Brad as my driver expert coach. You've been my video coach. So whilst Brad's going, no, take a bit more grass, it doesn't matter, the inside wheel can do that. You're like, that transition was a load of garbage. What are you doing? You've embarrassed yourself, you galah.
Yeah, well, you can easily embarrass yourself. I mean, all of us can, I suppose. But yeah, I mean, learning the basics of video is so something hard. That takes a bit of time. And, you know, it's not something you just pick up and immediately get good at.
And I think in the context of talking about the F1 broadcast, it is really, really important to remember that what they're attempting is very, very hard. We are talking like something near like the pinnacle of video and broadcasting skill.
Yeah, it's a really complicated process. And the way they've chosen to do it now, and they do it the way they do it these days, is actually a little harder, but it gives them better control in the long run. And it does turn out a better quality product for the whole world.
And we are also going to be doing Meet the Panel. So you're going to find out all about Steve's work in television. So he's going to be joined by another person who has low-key, to you non-Danish speaking people, low-key done an awful lot within media. It's Christian Pedersen. Hey, Christian.
Good evening. Good day, it is.
Yeah, we're doing it in the morning to pander to Steve. Yeah, we're pandering to the Australian time, which means, you know, it's 11 a.m. I can still taste the toothpaste.
It's evening for Steve, right?
Mm. Yep.
That is how the world works, and I don't get it.
Yeah, the world is absolutely crazy. People in different places experience different things, and I'm really looking forward to the Meet the Panel with you as well, Christian, because the UK viewers know you as a sultry-voiced and handsome Viking giving your opinions, but in Denmark, you were a bit of a 90s Anton Deck, unable to even go on a simple boat ride without swarms of fans.
I'm not sure if the Anton Deck was the right comparison, but I'll take it. I know I gave it to you, but I just had to put something in there.
Yeah, well, their career has continued going up towards the
20s. Yeah, that is where I differ.
That's fair enough. But you definitely have a lot of experience in media and broadcasting. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to get these two to talk through the history of Formula One and also the future of Formula One broadcasting, interlaced with some of the amazing listener feedback we've got. And if you don't mind, gentlemen, I want to start with the positive. So I'm going to get a comment from Jose in our Patreon Slack chat, who says, every time I watch an American race, IndyCar Championship or Daytona 24 Hour, and I want you all to remember Jose said this, not me, yeah, I get a renewed appreciation of how awesome the F1 broadcasts are in comparison. So I think Jose's got a point in which we absolutely take F1 broadcasting for granted. So I want to take it in that context. And Karen also added, whilst there's lots of areas to improve, I want to acknowledge how far it's come. I think the biggest reason I didn't get into the sport deeply as a child is because I watched my dad get very frustrated with the scrolling timings for the drivers. I would stare intensely, waiting to see how the drivers I cared about would be doing, and then they wouldn't come up. So when I first started watching on Drive to Survive and I saw they had even something as simple as a permanent tower with all the drivers, I was instantly interested in getting back into it. So not only is the Formula One broadcast great, but it's also come a long, long way. So I think that's a good place to start, Steve. I also tuned into the Daytona 24 and I thought exactly the same thing as Jose. Like, that was a great broadcast, but I went, oh, wow, like F1, it really is good.
Yeah, I watched some of the Daytona 24 too. I mean, we've got to, you know, we get it pretty good and we take it for granted, particularly these days, that we take it for granted that on a Sunday afternoon, well, Sunday night, midnight for me, that we can sit down, watch a race live, and the same race is being seen by everybody around the world. Now, add to, you know, that whole thing with, you know, which is through satellites and you know, instantaneous broadcasting, add to that the internet. And as you know, from our Slack group, our F1 Slack group, we sit and we watch the race and we can talk to each other about what's happening and make comments. And I mean, that's a level of involvement that was just, you know, inconceivable. Even maybe, you know, even 20 years ago, it was inconceivable. And on top of that, the level of their technical prowess that these people, you know, that they've brought to the coverage of the sport is phenomenal. I mean, it is instantaneous. Well, it's near enough to instantaneous live coverage all through the world. Everybody in the world sees the same thing. And the coverage is really very good. The amount of, you know, cameras they use, the kind of backup graphics and data that is fed to us, as well as the pictures of the cars going around, is phenomenal these days. I mean, back when I started watching, you saw the cars blurrily on, you know, low resolution 4x3 screens. They were color, but Jesus, only just. And the graphics that we had were awful. You know, you were lucky if they put up, you know, a graphic with the top three drivers in it every so often. And I've got to say that the Formula One guys do it better than anybody else in the world, really. And I think it's only because they have a lot more experience in doing it. They do it not every week, but every, you know, second week throughout a year for, well, what did we have last week? The last year, 23 races last year, going to be 24 this year. So they get lots of practice at it. The American Daytona is on once a year.
Steve, you only have to look at Monaco to go, well, when there's a broadcast team that, that doesn't do it week in, week out, suddenly you see the seams straight away. Yeah. And look, absolutely not slating the Daytona coverage. It's just that that made you kind of realize how difficult a thing it was and how good a job Formula One does. So it's just, it's so hard to follow motorsport that, you know, we've experienced from trying to set up karting angles for karting events and for iRacing events to really paint and create that narrative of a story of what's going on a racetrack is really difficult.
I completely agree with what Steve just said. But I also want to say there's a difference in a 24-hour race and a sprint race, which is Formula One. Firstly, Formula One is the Super Bowl or the Champions League of engineering, right? That is data-driven. We should get that data. And that is, I mean, Formula One does a brilliant job in providing that data, whereas Daytona or Le Mans or that kind of race is a bit more about what could potentially happen in 12 hours, right? So the 0.001 difference is maybe not as interesting, but I do want to say that watching a race is the broadcaster sort of has a deal with the viewer these days. Back in the days, the broadcaster bought the rights, showed it, everyone was happy. I get to go there, I can see, watch it, and that's it. Nowadays, the viewer has much more demands, and they can go everywhere. So today, you think, like, yesterday you thought like this, I just need the rights, then I got the money, the board will be happy. Nowadays, you think, I need to get the rights, and then I have to present it in a way that I get engagement. So that's a completely different way in producing, I'd argue. And Formula One is just, I mean, they're just way ahead of everyone else.
There's going to be a lot of young people, and we're all old enough, we can complain about the stupid young people. I also want to complain about how Steve says data, because that gets me every time. Data. It's just wrong. How other people speak is funny. So the young people will be looking at this going, well, we're just, you know, we've grown up in a world where you have all this information. Steve marveling about, have you heard the internet? You can all talk to each other. So obviously for some people, they will have landed in this world with all that stuff already existing. Now we are all, shall I just say, we're all over 42. And, you know, we remember the golden times of not really knowing what was going on. And that Karen's point with the graphics was really on point. If you were lucky, you would get P4 in the left side of the screen, P5, and then in a big graphic, you'd see, 0.5 gap. But you couldn't really paint that narrative of what was going on up and down the track. Whereas now, when you've got the live timings and that timing tower, you can see the whole race. And so whilst there's still areas and suggestions where they could improve, and we've got some great listener suggestions, the picture of the race is so much more now, Steve.
Oh, yeah. And there's more to be told now than there was before. You know, the cars are faster, closer. There's more at stake. You know, the ability to be able to pull data out, I mean, it's got to be relevant. I'm not going to change the way I say it.
Fine.
But the ability to be able to pull that data out and display it in a way that helps augment the viewer's, experience without getting in the way and cluttering things is a real secret in itself. And Formula One these days, I think, does a pretty good job. There'll be lots of people who criticize some of the graphics that we've seen recently, you know, like tire wear graphics and, you know, overtake will happen in, you know, the next three laps and that sort of thing.
Was F1 doing the one where it was the distance to the barrier? Was that F1? Where it was an AWS graphic, I'm sure. That was
Yes, it was.
We don't need that one.
That was during the last year. But they're trying things. We'll often see them try that, like how close to the wall there was, and it'll disappear in a couple. It'll stay for two races, and then it'll disappear because they've figured out that that's not working for them. They're not they're not hanging on to things that aren't working. So, I mean, we've got to be thankful for that. I mean, there are lots of other criticisms we can make of the graphics display we've got these days. But they keep trying things and they are honing it down, and it is getting better each year.
And yeah, and we're lucky to get to the point where we can take it for granted. I want to pick Steve's brains about the history of F1 broadcasting and then move on to the future. I'm not saying you're the past and Christian's the future of Mr. Apex. Don't interpret it like that. But I think let's just start off with a little bit on the graphics and the presentation from some listener questions. So a big criticism, and you've led us into this, Steve, is the way the facts are presented to you. Most of the comments, literally most of the comments, were about showing the replays at the start. So Barry says, please don't show the replays a million times at the start, just as DRS is enabled, or for goodness sake, split screen the start replays. Christian says the same. Where's Adam? Loads of people chiming in that they're infuriated with this multi-replay.
I've read them. And I've got to say one thing. A lot of people were saying F1 TV does it well. They do it with, you know, PIP, picture in picture, whenever they're showing replays and whenever they're showing re-showing the start. I've also got to point out, and they were criticizing, you know, Sky and saying, well, why can't Sky do that? Now, I've got to say that you've got to remember that once the race starts, Sky have the same feed as everybody else in the world, and that is supplied by Formula One. So Formula One are being greedy and keeping this picture-in-picture ability for their own F1 TV, and they are not implementing
it. Is that right?
On the world feed. They could do that, but they want to give their F1 TV broadcast a little bit of something extra.
I actually didn't know this, and I'm enraged. So if you're watching on F1 TV, you do get that picture-in-picture as standard.
You get picture-in-picture pretty standard.
That's chosen by the director, not as a feature that you can select.
Yeah. And the rest of the world gets the world feed, which is fed out of Biggin Hill by F1, and we take it or leave it. And they keep the cream for themselves.
So you have a product, and that product, to get that product out to the buyer, you have to use a middleman, right? That could be Viaplay, that could be Sky, that could be whoever. That is the Bernie way of doing it back in the days. That was what Bernie created, which Steve will get it back to. But how about if you could just cut out the middleman? Then you can just present it yourself, and you do that best by making a product where people have to go and buy your product directly. And that is by giving them a little bit more in the F1 TV Pro package.
Well, I agree with that. And when Liberty got involved and they announced that they were going to have F1 TV, we all figured that what would happen with Sky and with Foxtel here in Australia, and with beIN, you know, in Asia and Middle East, that they would all not have their contracts renewed, and that eventually F1 TV would be released to the whole world. Well, now that hasn't happened, because recently F1 has renewed the contracts of Sky through to 2030. Similarly for Foxtel, I don't know what the expiry dates of beIN are in Asia, but they will be similarly, you know, fairly long range. So what they're really saying is, you people in Australia, England, I mean, it applies to Italy, Germany, and probably most of Europe, I would think, is that, you know, you will take what we give you, and that will be a slightly second-rate presentation. If we could get F1 TV Pro, I'd do it tomorrow. But unfortunately, because of the Foxtel contract down here, we can't get it as an app that we can use.
Which is someone to blame for. That is Bernie, which leads us to Steve.
well, hang on. Bernie was originally to blame. I'll certainly agree with that. But it was Liberty that have renewed all the contracts for Foxtel TV down here and Sky TV in, you know, England and Europe. So if they wanted to do the right thing and broadcast, you know, a greater set of data and stuff to the rest of the world. Why did they renew those contracts?
I have the answer for that, at least part of the answer. And that has to do with the way the contracts was constructed back in the days and for how long you sign up for and what's in the contracts, basically. So Bernie, no one would do a contract with Bernie if they didn't have, if they weren't offered the next contract as the first partner, for instance. That could be a part of a contract, right? And if they want F1 TV Pro in your area, that contract would still have some benefits when you think of like that big of a commercial competitor coming into your market. So Fox would this is the way it works in the big brands, right? Fox, Viaplay here is doing it, Sky in the UK. They have so much power and they are so much on the market that this is the basis of their entire business. And we can see it with Viaplay in Holland, Denmark, Norway, and Sweden, I think, maybe even Finland, I'm not sure. There's big problems in this company. I think the share is about a tenth right now. And they have issues. They are firing people. And this is the product how do you call it? Basically catfishing people, getting them to sign up for something that is not really what it's supposed to be. And that is what's happening in your country. It's all in the contract. And I've read this. I haven't read it said in one line, but I've heard Liberty people saying this between the lines several times. The end goal is to be free of these contracts, but it's going to take at least 10 years to get around these old contractual obligations, I'm pretty sure.
I knew you two were the right people for this topic. I didn't realize how nerdy you were about international F1 TV contracts, and we're only starting to scratch the surface here. I will circle back to the point the listeners were making about the picture-in-picture. I appreciate your segue, Christian, and I know you've done a lot of radio at a much higher level than I have, and you've been on TV, and you've been an international superstar DJ, but this is my shed, okay? Only I segue to Steve here. Christian, right. So the picture-in-picture was a very, very deliberate... Sorry, the replays were a very deliberate feature. So I was invited as part of a press junket to a Liberty Media thing on the future of broadcasting. And I think it was all a big push when AWS was a partner. And so I get on this call and it's a very boring Italian journalist before me on the virtual press junket. And then I'm face-to-face with a very famous... I won't name him, but he used to be Massa's race engineer on the call with me. And I'm like, oh, Spanner's missed Apex podcast. We've got 15 minutes to talk about such and such. And he went, oh, it's a podcast, is it? And he looked left and right, like so surprised, because podcasts don't get invited on those press junkets, or they never used to. And he said, so am I on a podcast now? And I went, is that okay, sir? And he's like, oh, okay. So I don't think they were doing any podcast appearances at that time. But he leaned into it and he was fine. But he was at length talking about how it was a really big push from Liberty to give you information and access to information that you'd never had before, like really overload it. So things like reaction times. Do you remember that? That didn't last long. But they used to do driver reaction times at the lights. And then the big thing they were so proud of was the replays. So it was a deliberate thing to go, we are going to show you the start replay because that's the most exciting bit. We'll wait for things to settle down and then replay, replay, replay. And I think if you'd have done that to a 90s audience, I think we'd have been actually really happy with that, the chance to sit and pick apart the replay. Because we used to go, it's turn one and now nothing's happened. But we're a bit more educated now. And I think now if we look at the live timing during the first stint of a race, we can try and pick apart what they're doing. We can go, they're tire saving. Oh, they're pushing to try and get that place. Oh, he's out of position. So we understand all that stuff now. And the modern audience, Steve, is infuriated to be taken away from that to watch the start replay at that point.
Yeah, and they usually drop the replay in just as DRS comes into count. So that's when, there's a whole new level of interest in there. The cars are still close together. They've only done a couple of laps. DRS comes on and they cut to the, you know, replay of the start. And I have nothing against replaying the start, but put it in picture in picture in picture for the whole world, not just for F1 TV.
I think it's important to notice that in as you know, Steve, in TV production, well, in any kind of production, every decision is a choice, right? So at some point you have to show the replay, but when do you do it? So I used to work on a lot of like big live shows, like, you know, when you, you know, collect money for cancer research or whatever on primetime TV. And when you do these shows, they are one-offs. And you have to get a producer doing the picture, work with someone doing the sound and maybe 10 camera feeds. And then you have all the graphics and stuff. And it's all like a big mixture of things that has to work together. And when you get it to work, it looks brilliant, right? But when you do it on a Formula One basis where you do 24 a year, you get into a rhythm, right? You sort of like build up a system where does what work? And that is why we see something that is being perfected in every race. It just gets better and better. But the replay, you have to at some point take a decision and say, we have to show the replay, but when? And I think this is something that is under constant evaluation. Where do you put it? Do you put it picture in picture? Where do you put it? Yeah.
Well, you can show the replay at any time you like if you do it picture in picture, because you're not going to be cutting out what's happening on the track at the same time.
I agree.
I think that, you know, by embracing picture in picture, they would make the decision much easier for themselves.
And then when they do that, we'll all complain that the screen is too cluttered. Why can't they just show us what's going on the track? But yeah, there's been a huge variety in opinions with the listener comments. And I didn't realize how much of a sort of a passionate response we would get. But it does vary. It does vary from just show me the race. No frills. I just need to see what action is happening on track. All the way to people who want it to emulate Ready Player One, where they can, I want 80% of my field of view taken up with information, and I think I can do that without having a seizure.
Well, I think we could do with less crowd shots.
Oh, my goodness. Are we going there? Are we going to crowd shots? But that's, okay, so that is very much a
director's choice. Yes, it's...
And okay, here's what infuriates me. There's a very specific example, and it was Hamilton versus Bottas at Silverstone. So they're both still in championship contending at this point. I think it might be 2020. So they go down the Wellington Strait under the bridge into one of the greatest complexes for wheel-to-wheel racing in the entire world. F1 at Silverstone into Brooklands and Loughfield is... You must know that anywhere on earth you're going to see racing action... That and then into Cops, and they come down the Wellington Strait. A move is happening as they're about to go into Loughfield, and they cut away to a crowd shot. And you go, well, like I'm sure the individual who did that loves their children, and they're very nice, and they always rewind the videotape before they return it to the rental store. But how can you be a motorsport director and cut away at Loughfield on lap one between the two title contenders? Christian, I'm still so mad.
I think it's important to get into the head of someone. There's a guy who's producing this show, right? And then he has a guy who switches the cameras for him. So all this has to be a story. And you have to prepare something. As I said before, you have to prepare when do you do these and these stuff. So when you put on the graphics, the sound guy knows you have to put in the meow, right?
That's a great sound.
And then everything is working. I tried to do it from the left to the right. I don't know if it worked. It's probably a mono mic.
But that was V12, though. You need to update it.
Thank you very much. But still, it's the guy producing, his job is to have the overview. But when you're hands-on, you are maybe thinking more, well, it's been a while since we saw some fans. It's been a while since
we've got a checklist.
Probably not in the race as we are as viewers. At least as viewers... We are all in the race in 20 different ways, depending on who we follow and stuff, right?
Yep. The structure of the directorial structure of F1 these days is that there's not just one director. There are probably three altogether. The first guy is only concerned with following the cars, and he's cutting you know, to follow. He's being told by the guy who sits above him, the producer, okay, we want to follow Hamilton. We want to follow Max. And so he's cutting just the stuff on track, making certain that he's picking up those shots. Guy that's sitting above him is the guy that is saying, okay, want to see Hamilton, and we're going to go to a helicopter shot now. So the helicopter shot gets cut in. We're going to see Hamilton come into the pit, so we'll go to the pit lane cameras. Sitting next to him is another whole team that are purely graphics. And they're deciding when the graphics are going to come up, what graphics are going to come up to support what's being shown on the broadcast. So that's three teams. And then there'll be an overall, you know, executive producer or producer of the broadcast whose job is to make certain. Oh, there's a sound department. Yeah. Spanners will hate me saying this.
You know. Just the sound.
We forgot about the sound. The sound's
just there. It's always there. You know, never worry about it.
And if I can just add, Steve, to what you're pointing out, when you have like a chopper in the air and the chopper is stand by somewhere and we are like, and we're ready for the chopper, 3, 2, 1. When that is go, that is going to overrule everything else. Mm-hmm. So you could have Hamilton and Rosberg in corner 4 in Barcelona, but if the chopper was on his way, you're going to cut to the chopper. Unless you make an executive decision, and those executive decisions, the overruling ones, are the difficult ones to make. That is where you get like the strange feet somewhere where you're like, what was that? That is someone trying something. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but you cannot go back on a decision. You cannot say, let's cut to the chopper and then cut back to track. Then it's sort of like when first you say A, you have to see B.
I guess the secret is, if you're following Hamilton on the track and you want to go to a chopper shot, make certain the chopper's got Hamilton in view when you cut to him, so that the narrative keeps flowing on. See, there are two different things. There is the concept of showing the race, which is easy. We'll just show cars going around on the track. But there is another whole level to this, which is telling the story. And that's where a good director or a good producer earns his money, because he is in tune with the story that is going on the track, what's important, and what he needs in order to be able to tell that story rather than just show cars going around.
Maybe you need a useful idiot. So you need me in the corner, someone who's just concerned with audio, Steve. Someone who's like excitedly just pointing at the screen so the director can quickly glance at me. And when I'm jumping up and down screaming at Hamilton and Bottas having a fight into Luffield, he can be like, no, that's very clearly the priority. So you get all those technical arguments, Christian. I understand, or I'm pretending to understand all those technical arguments, but that, you know, these guys are under pressure, obviously, but that's a clutch move. So making sure you catch the championship leaders going into Luffield, that is almost as high pressure a performance thing as the guy at the free throw at the NBA Super Cup.
Yeah, but the as Steve says, I totally agree with this. The story is the most important. Don't you know if you remember this movie from, I think it was the 70s, the onboard movie Driving Through Paris? What was it called? The Getaway or something.
That brilliant. That was just brilliant.
Yeah, and that is just one onboard camera, just low to the ground, going through Paris at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. Maybe a little bit artificial sound, but that was just the story. That was just you felt it.
Brilliant.
And here it you have 20 cars. You could do the same on from 25 different directions, right? So they have all the tools to tell the story. And when you have so much, that makes it difficult as well. When you are constantly in danger of being overtaken by reality, just punching stories at you. So however you choose to tell your story, you're going to have to work with reality, right? And that makes it quite difficult, actually. And I think they are doing a brilliant job at it, Formula One, doing this.
It's one of those jobs, though, and I'm sure Steve will know this as... So we've got a good hybrid mix here. We've got producer Steve, we've got Christian, talent... Me neither really, but a hybrid between the two. And, you know, that behind the scenes thing is no one will notice you until it goes wrong. So we're sitting here. I am willfully ignoring all the great work they did that day for this one cutting to a crowd shot.
Yeah, I mean, it is. And everyone makes mistakes. Everyone thinks they've got the call right and occasionally will blow it. And Christian is dead right when he says, once you've made that mistake, you can't try and cover it. You've got to live with it and run with it and find the exit. And that's just the reality of life. That's why those people get paid money.
I need to add something here because Spanos is always down-talking himself. You are the talent. You are the backbone of this podcast. And I've told you this maybe 20 times. Spanos, I love you. You are the best host on podcast, not even only Formula One included.
You're the only one on the panel who says nice things about me.
Everyone likes you. Aww. And you. Yes. Honestly, I think it's about time someone told you.
Thank you. And it's very enjoyable to do. And I don't know how to respond with that. So I'm going to awkwardly go to the cricket analogy that was in my head, which is basically what you're describing, Steve, is if you're going to slash hard, which I believe was an Aussie captain who used to say that. I don't know if it's Ricky Ponting. I think that might have been his phrase going back. So he's going, if you're going to take a swing at the ball and you're not sure, make sure it's a hard, wild swing. Be committed to it. So I am going to ask Steve to take us into the past. We've all been looking at some footage, which through video magic might appear here on the YouTube right now, of historic F1. Take us to the very beginning, Steve. What were the first F1 broadcasts like?
Well, camera work actually started before F1 was a thing. I mean, the very first races started in Europe in 1900 to sort of 1902 and 3. And those early races had camera coverage. And you can see it, you know, it's all black and white. It was pretty, you know, they just had some cameras on the side of the road and the cars drove by.
Yeah.
There was occasionally a pan shot and you could see people, you know, at the finish line. But that's in 1902 or 3. I mean, the truth is that the development of the car and the camera kind of went hand in hand. And so the two things, you know, were complementary. Everyone loves seeing a car, even if it was only going at 30 miles an hour in those days. It was still a lot faster than a horse-drawn carriage.
So you see the super, super early ones, like the pre-F1 ones that you were talking about. And these things are, they're on wheels. And to us, they look like just like a horse and carriage, but without the horse. But to the people watching at the time, it just must have been extraordinary to see these machines rattling past.
And that's why they got big crowds in those days. I mean, it was a new sporting undertaking. No one had ever seen it happen before. I don't know whether they had horse and buggy races back before the cars were around in those, you know, at the end of the 1800s. I've got no idea. But as soon as cars came around, there were car races and people flocked to them. That old footage shows crowds of people dangerously lining these tracks as the cars come flying by. And it stayed pretty much like that up until the 1950s. The camera technology got a little better. It wasn't quite so flickery and grainy and nasty. Film stocks improved, but it was still basically single cameras. And the very first Formula One Grand Prix at Silverstone in 1950, it was covered in basically the same way. They had two or three cameras around the track. They panned and watched the cars as they went by. And then that footage was then developed and cut together. A voiceover was put on it and they were turned into, you know, basic packages, you know, review packages, various lengths, I suppose. I mean, I suppose 7 or 8 minutes was about average. And they would have been shown on BBC, probably on the weekend sporting program. And they were also shown at the cinemas, you know, in the newsreel packages that were put on before the main features.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, something I've noticed looking at that early Silverstone footage from the 50s, it was suddenly a step up, and this might seem really odd, but I still got that Grand Prix watching feeling when looking at it, and I went, that is, even though it was hay bales and unrecognizable cars and very much middle-aged men doing it, so I still got that feeling of Grand Prix, and the, you know, royalty was there, the glamour was there. So we complain about cutting to celebrities, but you know, they were pointing to the, you know, the Queen's kid or whatever.
You know what the difference was? That footage had a voiceover on it that was describing the story. The footage was backing up the story. It was adding context and excitement to what was being seen. That early footage, the 1900s footage, was just cars going by. There was no one saying, and here comes, you know, yes, Joe Bloggs, and he's, you know, 45 miles an hour, and he's half a mile in front of, you know, the other guy. There was none of that attempt to tell a story. It was just showing, it was just showing cars going by, you know. By 1950, you know, filmmaking had got slick enough so that when they showed the cars going by at Silverstone, they had someone telling us what the exciting part of it was, and the footage backed it all up. So I think the voiceover was the thing that suddenly, you know, jumped out at me.
Yeah, and Christian was watching back then in the 50s. You were just warming up for you.
I think I was born when Steve was in his prime in TV in Australia, actually. must have gone through the biggest evolution in technical. I mean, were back there when everything was, I think it cost £1 million just to look at a camera.
Yep. When I first started at the ABC, which was the Australian version of the BBC in 1972, it was black and white. Everything was black and white. They had videotape machines, but trying to do an edit on one of those 2-inch videotape machines was pretty hard, pretty outrageous.
Did you have to cut it with scissors and then...
You could actually line up two videotape machines and you would use a sync pulse. You would run it through, and at the point you wanted the edit to happen, you would hit a button and that would put a sync pulse on the... on the record machine. You would then run the two machines back 10 seconds apiece, line them up, and then manually hit the two start buttons together. And when the record machine read the sync pulse, it would cut to the input of the new videotape coming in.
Okay.
It took a long time to do any of that stuff. It wasn't like it is today.
Who votes the rest of the show is just Steve talking about the olden days. and then a kid would come in with a newspaper saying, extra, extra, read extra. All about it. And you'd have to redo your newsreel for the day. Okay, yep. Well, look. I think Christian was right when he was trying to move you on to the Bernie era, because love him or loathe him, Bernie Ecclestone probably, I think unarguably, is what thrust Formula One into the national and international conscious.
Yeah, just prior to Bernie, the televising of Formula One, you know, races were undertaken by each country. They did their own race. You know, there wasn't a lot of coordination between people. You know, BBC might get Italy's you know, coverage they'd done, and they would show that during their sports program, whatever. In the late 70s, in the mid to late 70s, that became a reality. Bernie, who was a team owner in those days, realized that owning a team wasn't going to make him a rich man, and he wanted to be a rich man. So he started to organize the teams he could see that the broadcast rights, if you did this correctly, would be worth a lot of money. So he organized the teams into an organization called FOCA, the Formula One Constructors Association.
Can I just add something, Steve?
It's
important to remember back then there was no deals. So one race would probably have something broadcasted, other races would not. And some races was a Formula One race, some was not. And no one basically knew.
Yep, that's exactly right. Bernie saw that if it was organized correctly, they could sell it to a world market. And he wanted to be the man that would do that. He was the one that started to establish... help organize FOCA in 1974 he started, and that kind of gave the teams some clout. I mean, it eventually led to the signing of the first Concorde Agreement,
We hear that so much, that word Concord Agreement, and I've been too afraid to ask what it is.
Well, it's an agreement between the FIA and the teams about how the race seasons will be run, how other ancillary things like media rights will be distributed and where the monies will go from those, who owns what in terms of...
I think it's between FOM and the teams, right? I'm not sure FIA is in the Concord, are they?
I think they would the first Concord Agreement.
Maybe back then, yes.
Yeah, I think it may have changed. That there were two organizations, one was called FOCA and one was called FISA, which was the pre-runner to the FIA. And it was when FOCA was set up, there was almost 10 years worth of arguments and to-ing and fro-ing between FISA and FOCA about who would, have the rights to stuff and who would be in control. FISA turned into the FIA, and FOCA is still around now, but FOCA gave up most of its powers to Bernie and his companies, which were called FOPA, the Formula One Promotions Administration.
But here's the thing, though. From a broadcast point of view, this is Bernie Ecclestone like seizing power and then setting about going, well, how can I make money? And I'm sure the broadcast put part of that is a key element to it, obviously.
That was the most important one. Here's a really interesting quote about Bernie Ecclestone and how he did this. And I quote, "Anyone who has had a business, sold it four times, has never bought it back, and has never lost control of it, and still owns it, is pretty special. And you know the most important thing? He never freaking owned it in the first place."
That sounds very Bernie-ish.
No, okay. that's Eddie Jordan.
Yeah, yeah, about
that's
Bernie.
What Eddie Jordan yeah. But yeah, he never owned it. He sold it four times, made a huge amount of money out of it, never lost control of it, but he didn't own it in the first place. Early 2001, he did a deal with the FIA that gave his company, Slick, the rights to the Formula One transmission rights for 100 years. It was announced in 2001. It didn't actually come into, become active until 2010, when the agreement that was in place in 2001 came to an end. And it was that agreement that Liberty ended up buying. So Liberty now have control of FOM, which has control of the broadcast rights for Formula One until 2109. It just seems pretty weird. Bernie didn't pay all that much for those rights. You've got to remember that the man he was negotiating with was, why am I having an old person?
But it's okay, you're doing very well.
Who was head of FIA before John Todd?
That's a great question, something that I would have to Google. I tell you what, everybody listen to old man Googling. FIA.
Max Mosley.
How could we forget that?
Yeah, well, you've got to remember that Max Mosley and Bernie had been, in bed together, brothers in arms, since the 70s.
I think that's the wrong analogy to
use
with Max
Mosley.
So.
Well,
I think that's why
considering.
Well, perhaps not the right. Yes, all right. No. Perhaps that was wrong. But nonetheless, they had been thick as thieves since the 1970s. Max worked for Bernie for many years.
That'll go.
In all sorts of ways. And it was at Bernie's suggestion that Max stood for the chief of the FIA. So with those two guys running, they ran the whole thing thick as thieves. And then he onsold it to CVC and their partners, who eventually sold it to Liberty. Again, with Bernie's, it was Bernie that set up the deal and all that sort of stuff. Of course, all the other deals during the early 2000s with EMTV and with Kirsch and those sorts of people, they left Bernie alone to run it. And he kind of figured that would happen with Liberty too. They would come in, they would buy it. They would leave him to run it. That didn't happen. John Malone, who owns Liberty, is a smart media operator, and he decided he would do it his own way.
Right, I want to get away from the business side and onto some on-camera stuff, because that stuff, Steve, must have, you know, has evolved like an awful lot. When you think of static camera positions and you've just got Billy Bob with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth trying to track the cars as best he can, to now where there's almost complete coverage to helicopter shots, drones, cable cameras. Like, that evolution, I feel like I've seen that as a 42-year-old. In my lifetime, I've seen that suddenly explode.
Yeah, it's huge these days. F1 runs everything out of Biggin Hill outside London. That's where their main transmission centre is. They send 150 people to every race. Their cameramen, sound guys, you know, data collectors, all that sort of stuff. All of that data is collected and sent back, straight back to Biggin Hill. You know, for every session, Tata are their F1's, you know, data partner. And they have huge, you know, fiber optic cables going right around the world, and they send every camera output goes straight back to Biggin Hill and comes up on the monitor there, and that's where the directors decide how to use it. For the figures I've been able to find is that it's about 150 people. There's between 30 and 40 4K broadcast cameras that go all the way around the circuit, and they're the ones that we see. There's 60 in-car cameras, 150 microphones, and they lay about 50 kilometres of fibre cables at every track. I mean, and then they've got to be pulled up and moved. So it's a huge, huge undertaking. Then they have microwave antennas that send camera signals and data and all that sort of stuff. And they obviously set up a big media centre, temporary media centre.
So it's hundreds and hundreds of people, right? So
That's just at the track. There's another 150 people back at Biggin Hill. So there's, you know, for every race, there is about 300 people involved in getting the, you know, the camera signals out to the rest of the world. They come into Biggin Hill, they go through the process we talked about earlier, being produced, and then they're fed out to the international feed that everybody takes for the race.
So when we judge something like Daytona 24, there's no way they have that level of manning and resources.
No, I wouldn't think so. I don't know exactly, but I'd be, you know, you've only got to look at it to be able to tell, that they don't have that kind of, you know.
So we definitely
have Radio Le Mans, right? They have this crew from Radio Le Mans, which is basically their entire content site, and then they just have a TV production from the infield of the Daytona.
Yeah, and you've got to understand that covering Daytona is a simpler process than covering most Formula Ones, because it is basically, you know, an oval with a little infield thing. So the number of cables, the kilometres of cables you've got to run to get from the cameras back to the broadcast centre is less, you know, line of sight is easier, microphone cables not as far. All of that stuff is scaled down a lot.
And the speeds we have in data transmission these days
are
at a point where you can basically do this back home. You can have your sound department back home. You can have everyone who's doing the onboard stuff and stuff like that back home. So things are definitely changing in that regard. And I think we will see in the future probably more remote stuff.
I mean, the next thing is that they'll send the cameras out and get techs to set them up, and they'll all be operated from back in Biggin Hill. I mean, at the moment, the amount of data that is sent back during each race is 500 terabytes. That's a bucket load of data to be sent back in real time.
That's half a gigaflop. God. I don't know computers. I don't know.
Did someone say gigaflop?
Is that a thing? I don't know.
They say that it takes 6 seconds from when something happens on the track for it, you know, to make its way back to Biggin Hill, for the production process to happen and for it to be retransmitted to the rest of the world.
That's interesting. 6 minutes, 6 seconds.
6 seconds. Now, we all know that because we have our, you know, Event 90 protocol when we're watching Formula One.
This is so that people avoid posting immediate spoilers, because people who do a stream tend to be about 90 seconds behind people who are watching it on cable or satellite. Mm.
That's a result of, you know, the Slack Foxtel stream, or the fact Slack Sky, what do you call it in Britain? What's their...
Oh, Sky Go.
That's because, you know, and their system is not quite up to the speed of the actual Formula One. But it's still pretty amazing. It's still, you know, 6 seconds happens on track. It's being transmitted to the rest of the world.
What we see nowadays is we talk about 4K, 8K, we talk about graphics on screen and stuff like that. But I think what will revolutionize the future is how we compress packages of data, which is, I know this is very unsexy, but when when you film something, you have to turn that into a digital format, and then you have to package it in a container, which is what we call MP4 or whatever you
that's
use.
That's right, yep.
Then you send it through data cables. That's data cables.
data is getting
exactly,
to you.
Yeah. Then you send them, then you have to unpack them and then watch them. That is also why your computer sometimes have issues with different formats and stuff. That is how the data is packaged. And that is going to revolutionize, because those packaging formats are going to get more and more intense and smaller and smaller and smaller. So you can send more and more and more. In the same lines you could before. But I also just want to add one thing that Formula One or Liberty Biggin Hill is doing that no one else is doing quite up to the task they are. And that is a production crew with on-screen hosts who are working well together. They are creative in how they perceive the sport, how they go about it, how they narrate their communication from the track, how they tell their story. They are ways ahead of everyone. Well, I haven't seen the Australian Fox, I haven't seen the German, but I've seen the Danish, I've seen the Sky one, I've seen the American one, and no one even reaches them to their socks. So they don't even not only have the site, the product, the rights, the way to transmit it, they also have the crew to present it now. So I think they are going to be a serious contender within a very short time frame. That is maybe 5 years.
Okay, presenting. This is where I feel, and empowered by my colleagues now to say I'm an expert on. We have to remember that the talent pool for people who could do that very specific presenting job is quite limited. It's the very top of a pyramid of talent. And I think, say, we've had loads of feedback here saying, I would replace such and such a person. Such and such a person is not a good commentator or presenter. If you took those people away and immediately went for the next train about to leave the station and put them in, you'd suddenly appreciate how good that previous person was. And I think one really good example is David Croft, who comes under a lot of fire from people, but he is so technically a great commentator. He's actually fantastic. He's an amazing voice smith. The amount of time he does it over the course of a weekend to keep it fresh, to keep it interesting, and you can argue about his excitement level if that is particularly to your taste. But he is technically fantastic. And if you were to just take away every commentator on Sky, F1 TV, the Danish, whatever's on the Danish one or the Dutch one, and have to replace them immediately, you would suddenly realize just how good those guys at the very, very top are. So I didn't include any of the listener comments of, oh, you should get rid of such and such a pundit or such and such a commentator, because honestly, these people are, I think, criminally underrated, Christian, in that day-to-day skill of delivering that presentation.
I totally agree. But I would add that in the past, you had, if you listen to Murray Walker, for instance, I know he's considered like the great, right? But he doesn't know anything. It's just crap,
that's
right?
True.
He's just guessing. So... And he's like, what is going on? It has four round black things. It's called so tires.
It was so frustrating. He used to always go, I know it seems like they're getting closer in the corners, but actually when they get to the straight, they'll get further away again. We all understand that it looks closer in the corners, Murray. We're okay.
And that is, I think, Crofty is a good example of a little bit of, I know you love him, Spanners, but he's sort of like the old school for me. He's very good at his craft. You can call Crofty in the middle of the night and just put a mic in his face, and he's going to do it at the same level of professionalism. Whereas if you listen to Jonathan Palmer, Jonathan Palmer? No, that's his dad.
Jolyon Palmer.
You listen to Sam Collins, yeah. Or those guys. They have, their mindset is a little bit fresher, and I think the new generation of fans, the Drive to Survive fans, they're going to adapt to the Formula One Liberty kind of vibe more.
Oh, we could do that. We could divert dream comms pairings in the future. So I don't feel as strongly as that about David Croft, but with Murray Walker. I do agree with you, and he was fantastic, and now he's carved in stone the template for motorsport commentators. But when Martin Brundle paired up with him, I felt like such a sense of relief. It was like, good. Thank you, Martin. You know, Martin saved F1 commentary for me. So even though I can't stand the gridwalk, I will hear no ill because he's F1 royalty.
I've just got to. You guys mentioned DTS, and although it's not, actually transmitting a race, that is the biggest thing that has happened to Formula One terms of media and broadcasting. Since the start of Formula One, it's the thing that has blown the top off the sport, brought in so many new people. Fans introduced it to them. It is the thing that has changed Formula One more than any other form of broadcasting, whether we like it or not.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think people are too very quick to dismiss, you're just a DTS fan. If you came into the sport because you were attracted by Drive to Survive and the characters and the drama of it, and then you still watched the races, saw it was substantially different to how it's portrayed on Drive to Survive, and you're still an F1 fan, there's no gate for us to keep. Like, you're welcome in. I think it's quite a good litmus test. If someone dismisses you for being just a DTS fan, that is a good indication to you that that person really isn't worthy of your time to debate with. Let's stop the Drive to Survive gatekeeping.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
I need to get this off my chest, though, because you mentioned Jolyon Palmer. Obviously, there's a lot of people waiting in the wings to take over as the next Murray Walker. But I can imagine 5 years' time, Jolyon Palmer as the Brundle for the main feed and Alex Brundle as the main commentator. The only thing of that is I'm not sure that Alex Brundle realizes he's the David Croft Murray Walker guy yet. So obviously he does a lot of commentaries. I think he wants to be the expert guy, which he could be, but I think he'll end up being the caller. So there you go. That's my dream F1 comms lineup for the future. Even though Jolyon Palmer, the only time I've spoken to him was on the BBC Checkered Flag podcast, and he yelled at me, and he was pretty mean. He yelled at me a lot. So did Andrew Benson.
I'm going to change my opinion then.
Okay, what are you changing it to?
Yeah, I don't agree, but don't front on spanners, I mean.
Yeah, we hate him now.
Exactly.
Okay, so I want to then, whilst we're sort of talking about the broadcast side, like the out-and-out picture side, maybe just a couple of listener comments here. And I think this is a key one here from Ernst. It doesn't look like the cars go fast anymore because all cameras follow the cars through corners. Cars come right towards you on the straights. It feels boring. Stephen backs him up. It achieves the impressive feat of making the fastest part of the race with the fastest cars look like they're doing 5 miles an hour. What do we do about that perception of speed, Steve?
Well, I don't necessarily agree with them. We could put, you know, just locked off shots and let the cars drive through the locked off shots. But in order to be able to tell the story of the race, that's really not going to do it. Those locked off shots would have to be so wide in order to be able to see what's happening that they're not going to be particularly exciting. Now, I have the same issue when I'm setting up iRacing for the Missed Apex thing. I go into a new circuit when we're going to do it, and I strip the cameras that are there out, and I build my own camera positions, and I go through this same thing every time. And I almost always end up going with the zoomed shots because it is easier to be able to tell the story. Now, you can make a car go fast by using a narrow field of view. You can make it look like it's going fast, but you only see a small amount of what's happening. The narrower the field of view, the less you're actually seeing of the track. Or if you're talking about a camera that's mounted on a car, the narrow angle of view means that what you're actually looking at is a part of the track that's 75 feet in front of the car. So it actually doesn't have a lot of relevance to, you know, what the car is experiencing at that particular moment. Now, it's a difficult thing. Part of the thing that makes them look slow is not that the camera angles are wrong, it's just that the cars aren't skidding all over the track like they used to. In the past, the cars, you know, it was physical traction and mechanical grip that the cars used, not a lot of aero. So they were bouncing and turning and going through a corner, you know, that they look fast because, you know, they were small, they were not particularly stable, and they looked exciting. These days, they're glued to the track. So yeah, the cars don't look particularly exciting, but I'm not sure that having locked off shots is going to make this work.
And the cars are buses, right? The cars are like the red double-decker buses in London, size-wise. And if you watch a race with big trucks, compare it to go-karts, even though the go-karts only drive half the speed of the trucks, the go-karts will look faster because they're more agile and moves around, as Steve says. That is one thing. I think generally we just have as you know, Steve, it's a giant task to get something to look fast if it's not like rocket spaceship fast on television. So if you watch, for instance, Daytona, that looks slow, right? And then you have the last thing, which is perception. So if you have like a DTS, Drive to Survive, where all the cars are going Michael Mann style. Yeah, I work with sounds and I have a mouth.
You're like that guy from Police Academy.
Well, not quite Spanish, but thanks. But, you know, if you build like a reputation on Netflix where all the cars sounds like they go faster than they do in reality, and then you turn on the race and it's like no, I think that ruins it too, but I don't see it that way. I think it looks good still, and if you see the Rouge shots and stuff like that, the Monaco shots, it's still, oh, I said the Monica word. I'm sorry, Spence.
No, that's okay. Look, it's interesting to see Steve's perspective. So we do this with our iRacing tournament. The first broadcast is going to be on February 9th. So I'll make sure to link to our motorsport broadcast channel. And it's really exciting to see, you know, what Steve picks and the choices you make. And in sim racing, there's shots that you can do that aren't available to TV camera crews yet. And you use them. So there's one that you argue with Brad about, which is iRacing will let you have a view that follows the car directly behind. And I think I saw some Red Bull promotion thing where they actually put a tether to a camera. And that's a great action shot. If the Formula One could have that, they would have that.
Yeah, absolutely they would. That's, you know, I mean, iRacing has one small advantage over F1 at the moment, and that is that, you know, virtual cameras actually work.
So it's the choices for the camera crews are interesting. In Formula E, in the early seasons, do you remember how painfully slow Formula E looked? If you're trackside, and I can tell you as someone who crossed a live track accidentally and then had the pack whiz past me very shortly afterwards, that was an alarming experience. These are very, very fast motor cars, and I was really close to Degrassi and Buemi crashing, and without the engine noises, the sickening crunch of carbon fibre really got that speed across to you. But what they would do occasionally is have really static shots on a curb and then let you the cars thundering past, and F1 tends not to do that.
Yeah, if you put the camera down low on the track and let the cars kind of run over the top of it, then they look very fast. And they do some tracks allow, you know, that kind of camera placement, but they don't do a lot of it. I'll agree with that. But that's the one way you can make a car look fast in a static shot, is make it low, and you can then have a narrow field of view so that the thing will pass through the field of view very quickly and appear fast.
It's the worst job as a camera operator, though.
Would you not? Would that not be an unmanned one? You don't just tell Derek.
Yes, of course it is.
Derek, can you lie down on the curb and go for it? Why me? Oh, you know why, Derek. I saw her looking at you at the barbecue. Now get out there and do your worst. So we are some hour and 10 minutes into this broadcast show, and already I've identified little areas where I go, Steve, can we just do a segment like specifically on drone cameras? You know, there's lots of breakout stuff with this, but there's one specific question that I'm looking for that was a listener question. And if I can't find it, I am sorry, I will make up a name. But there was a question about the use of the drone. So I think it's Paddy. Ah, there we go. It doesn't need to be a first person view drone trying to take a corner while following a car so everyone feels like they've fallen over. Just some good close-up drone shots. So something I think that is the difference between, say, a Castle Coombe broadcast and F1 D24 are those drone and helicopter shots. Like, they are some of the most spectacular shots in motorsport. And if you can follow the action, it's amazing. But yeah, we definitely don't need that one where we were all tilting, you know, around the Zandvoort banking or whatever.
No. Drone shots are great. They should be used for tracking alongside, next to the track, primarily on a straight, watching two cars trying to, you know, tussle with each other as they go down the straight. If you've got a drone that can sit over, you know, what, 20 feet in the air or 30 feet in the air and look down on those two cars fighting as they run up the straight, that's a very exciting shot, and it shows a brilliant view because you can see the two cars the way that they're tussling with each other. And for that reason, we use them in the iRacing drone shots. I love drone usage in that. And once they've, you know, get the drones sorted out and they're controllable, and I understand that you can't fly them over the top of the track, you don't have to. You've just got to find the right place on the track to use them. So, yes, I'm all for drone shots. I reckon that they will really improve the whole coverage.
I've got a long-term plan for Mist Apex, you know, karting events and series where we will have coverage. And obviously you and Ben help me with this kind of stuff. But at stage one, I've bought my son a little mini drone, and I've been training him. And it's big for a mini drone, but it's a mini drone. So he's learning to be my drone camera operator for that. And we did not realize how many laws there were around flying drones.
Oh, huge amount.
And when someone showed me the laws, I was just like reading through it going, whoa, boy, we did several crimes. Okay, cool. Let's study this now. So, Steve, thank you very much for that. That history has set us up nicely. And I learned things. And I think Biggin Hill itself is something we could sit and try and get someone on who has experience of Biggin Hill and sit and pick their brains. That could be a whole episode in itself.
That'd be great.
What about the future, Christian? Where are we going in the future?
I think the future is based on what the past was, basically, and it's all about rights. But I'm going to start somewhere else. If you look at the media landscape these days, you will hear all the big names like Amazon, Netflix, Microsoft. Everyone is just firing people. Microsoft just bought Blizzard, which is a huge gaming company, and they basically fired one third of the people hired there. And we see this everywhere. I think we have seen the peak in streaming content, and it's only going to go down from here. And that
really?
Is also why we see price hikes in subscription models, and we see advertisement introduced.
So people are cashing in. Is that what you think now? Is the this
yeah,
is the,
well,
the cow being milked?
Yeah, it's not been the most lucrative business up until now. It's been all about getting people to... I don't know if you remember back in the days when the mobile phone was introduced. There was, at least in my territory, there was this idea that if you could get people to buy a mobile phone, then you could hook them on the subscription, right? So mobile phone was basically for free. You could go and get the main 500-pound model for 1 krona in Denmark. That is 1/10 of a pound.
Yeah, and it has a hole in the middle, so it's worth even
less. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that is what has happened with the subscription platforms. And now they've realized that there is no more. And not everyone will survive. But it also says a lot about what content is and how you get people to subscribe and give you money. For instance, Netflix is 30% less content this year than it was last year. And it's more expensive. So as a customer, you will be sitting there, well, where do I use my money? And this is going to be a huge fight. And there is only one thing that you can be sure about is going to win you subscribers and interest, and that is global sports rights. And this is where Formula One comes in. I'm going to give an example from America where, Messi started playing for the MLS,
yes,
which is,
this is
Major League
yeah.
Soccer. And before Messi signed with Miami, he was being told about in the negotiations with Apple. Apple basically bought the world's rights for MLS. So anywhere in the world you want to watch MLS, you go through Apple. You have to need to have a subscription and an MLS plan on the Apple TV app, right? We've never seen anything like this before because Apple, a few executives and a handful of executives from the MLS basically just made this deal. And I've read interviews where some of the guys from MLS is just texting the guy, I think his name is Eddie Q from Apple, is why is the standings from the MLS not on the app web? And he's like, well, we'll fix that. Then 2 days later is there. This is completely new territory, right? This would never have happened in the Viaplay or Sky days. That would take half a year just to get in contact with that guy. So I think probably the hottest item on the streaming market right now is Formula One and probably Champions League. But still, Formula One is more. It's world. It's 24 times a year. And it's only going in one direction still.
Wow. This is okay, is it going in one direction? I mean, this is going to delve back into the business side, which I don't want to sort of dive back too much into. But
the base you had when Liberty took over Formula One is still expanding, right? And we saw an influx from the DTS series and stuff, which was unnaturally boosted. So, but we still see new people adapt Formula One. And it's the youth, it's the people you want to adapt because they're going to stay for the rest of their lives. And their kids are going to adapt as well. So this is just a different story. What I see coming, and I have no idea, I have no insight, I don't know Eddie Q from Apple, I don't know any of the people in Formula One, but there's a reason why everyone's so unhappy with Mohammed bin Salem from saying Formula One is not worth, what was it, 20 million or 2 million, whatever he said.
Yeah.
There's a reason for everyone being so unhappy about that. That is because all these things are going on in the background these days. And the value of Formula One is going to decide the price. M&S was bought for $2 billion.
Okay, but this is the thing. You're agreeing with what I was sort of trying to say out loud, which is ultimately Liberty are now entering the milking the cow phase, and that there will be a sale price at some point.
Definitely. There's no one else around who's done what Liberty has done with Formula One. They have basically made it better in every way. You can't really see anywhere where you feel like, well, yeah, that's me as a customer who's paying the price. Maybe it's a little pricey, but still, I mean, you pay 100, 150 quid for a year of Formula One. That is cheap compared to what you had to pay for Sky or whatever. They are going to juice it. They're going to pump up the price once you're in there and all the same things that everyone else. But I have seen no signs yet that they do not understand their customer, at least, that they are not reading their customer, where in the old days, no one read the customer. They only read the numbers at the end of the year, the budget, right?
Well, I probably would disagree with some of that.
Let's hear it.
Fight.
I think that Liberty run the risk of making Formula One so expensive that they are going to lose followers. You made the point that, you know, DTS has brought a lot of people to the sport, and it did it brilliantly, you know, through production values and showing drama. Some people would say building drama that doesn't exist in the DTS programs.
That's not Liberty, though, I just want to say.
Well, Liberty are paying the bills.
Yeah.
You know, Netflix are doing the production. Well, Box Now Productions, is that what it's called? Make it? Yeah. My point is that DTS sucks people in. They want to get involved in the sport. Then they find out that it's not the way that it has been portrayed in DTS. And not only that, to actually go to any one of the Formula One races these days, they've got to go and mortgage their house, sell their kids, because Liberty have bumped the prices up unbelievably. Now, they have done this very drastically, and they've done it in particularly nasty ways. Now, we won't go into this, but Liberty own Ticketmaster and Live Nation. Both of those companies have long histories of ripping people, my opinion, ripping people off, you know, that's my opinion only. But it's also the opinion of the American Department of Justice and, you know, their corporate people there. They're taking them to court because of the way that they sell tickets, because of the way that they don't look after the people that buy tickets. Now, that is now being transferred to the Formula One area. And I know just from the feedback from our people in our Slack group, a lot of them go to a lot of races, but they are now beginning to complain because the value isn't there anymore. What they get when they get to the races isn't what they've been sold and isn't what they want, as people who are going to do it. Now, my one last thing is, you said that, you know, these Drive to Survive people, it's their children that are going to be the future of it, of the sport. But what percentage of those children, how many of the people that have been bought in by Drive to Survive will end up then, once the glossy you know, first thing has worn off, we'll go back to watching NFL or NASCAR or basketball or soccer or whatever. So making, you know, you can't make great, you know, huge sweeping statements about, you know, how many millions of extra viewers we'll have. We don't know. There was some concern last year that the viewership was beginning to drop off.
Well, sadly, I don't actually think the viewership of Formula One dropping off is a major concern. And this is where I agree with Christian slightly, because if you can charge more for your ice cream, then you can get away with selling less ice cream. And unfortunately, this is a model we have seen with gaming franchises an awful lot. Anyone who's played the Far Cry series will know they built up a lot of goodwill through the first three or four, and then suddenly everything was pay to win, and you had to buy extra packs and downloads in order to be able to get extra hit points and kill the enemies. So at some point, if you see a product alienating its fan base, you know that they're making money and that there's an end game. So ultimately, we are kind of, you know, we are relieving ourselves in the wind because it's all blown back. We're sitting there going, but why don't they care about my specific thing that I think is good? Why are they putting me off? Because me as an individual, as much as I complain, I'm still paying. And there's enough people paying until they get to their exit point. And that's where I think you're correct. That's what we're seeing. We're going to get less. We're going to pay more for less until this cycle concludes.
I just want to add that Formula One is the Beyonce Jay-Z on the streaming market right now on offer, right? And it's for sale. And no one has bought it yet. So that is going to change stuff. I'm not completely into the DTS. I think DTS is going to be not as popular this year. We also already saw a decline last year. I think people adapting to Formula One are getting adapted to Formula One as it is as a sport. But anyway, let me just put one last point on the future of Formula One. And that has to do with Apple as well. This week, they released their glasses. They don't want us to call them VR, but it's basically VR.
VR,
so
AR, yeah.
Imagine next year's season Formula One. You buy these glasses. Season starts. You choose which car you're driving. You choose which perspective you're watching from.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that is the future. Augmented.
You son of a gun. I'm in. But look, it's not all bad news. It's good. If you're an F1 fan, you know, we've lived through F1 being boring. We've lived through Formula One being unpopular. We've lived through begging for teams to join. And we've lived through begging the Americans to go, it is cool, we promise. No, but six cars, that was still good. I mean, they were still six really cool cars, weren't they? So, you know, we go through these cycles. And at the moment, we're in the cool gang. Yeah. And there might come a time where it bleeds off and it again becomes a little bit more of a niche sport, but it will always survive. F1 is so strong at its core. It's the thing that we love, and we are going to be here for a long, long time. And maybe as it dips off, there'll be slightly less podcasts for us to compete against. So, you know, there's a plus side for everything. That is the end of the show. Feel free to tune out. But if you don't mind, I'm going to take another 15 or so minutes. Don't complain. Oh, that's not F1 related, because that's the point of Meet the Panel. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to set myself a time limit here, but I'm going to flip-flop between you two fine gentlemen. Now, we've got a strange generational thing here where we will do it. We can be big boys. We can say our ages. How old are you, Uncle Steve?
I'm almost 70.
Oh, 69. Nice. Okay, 70 years old.
Nice.
Christian, how old are you? Look at this. We're still school children. How old are you, Christian?
I should say 420, right? But I'm 52.
52. So we go from 69 to 52 to then 43. We have a weird phenomenon here because I spent a lot of time in Denmark as a kid and in the 90s. So I'm pretty sure I will have watched Christian on TV doing like pop chart shows. And it's as a kid, Christian, you probably watched stuff that Steve produced in America Land. So we've got this tower of old. Well, it's not a full circle. It's more like a line. It's more... Yeah, it's not a circle.
True.
So let's start with the more glamorous end, away from those dark and pale people in production like Steve. But Christian Pedersen, you're great on this show. You're outspoken. You've broken the beat machine many, many times. And we always get loads of positive comments when you're on. People mostly in the English speaking world will be completely unaware that in the 90s, you know, you were a TV personality. And at what level of personality were you at? You were talking to me earlier about, you know, the experience of just wandering around on public transport. Like, you were a legitimate Danish celebrity.
It's very difficult for someone like me who's not really interested in the attention when it comes down to it to answer that question. But I've been paid for signing autographs, if that makes sense. Like sitting in a shop just with people queuing up for autographs. That kind of famous. But, you know, it's all relative, isn't it?
There's always a bigger fish.
Yeah, do you want me to just go through quickly why it was?
Why are you the ant or deck of Danish TV?
I just loved radio back in the day, as you do, Spanners.
That's the
media, basically. And that led me to do TV. And I worked on something was called ZTV in Denmark and Sweden and Norway, which is basically our version of MTV. That was back when it was satellite TV. And I did that was how I learned to do TV, or you could say how not to do TV, or however you put it. I did 3 hours live at a time. So you broadcasted live for 3 hours, and I did it all with my earpiece open all the time. So I learned a lot from that period. And then I went on to the national TV station, and I did a show called Pulse. Or Pulse in English, which was youth music TV. And this was like 96-ish, and that was before the internet. I think I was the first TV host or media person in Denmark ever to do a thing on the internet where you can write me. And that broke the internet at the time. So the internet in Denmark just went down, basically.
And if you check the show notes, and you do have to, I did find 90s footage of Christian on TV with your blonde tips. And it is everything you're imagining right now. And if you think of Ryan Seacrest is in America in the UK, I'm trying to think who was our equivalent. Could it have been Philip Schofield? But you were like the people like cheerleading the youth into what they're supposed to be enjoying.
Yeah, but back then when you didn't have internet and you only had this like a couple of national TV stations, things was just only produced for the grown-ups, right? We did something for the youth. We had different kind of hair color every week and yellow glasses and said all the things the grown-ups didn't want us to say. And the grown-ups thought of us as stupid, but I mean, look at us now on the podcast.
There you go, yeah. But that's interesting ended up on TV sort of almost accidentally, because like you, I always, like, radio is my big passion. And if you're listening to this on Monday, I will already have been back at a fairly, you know, modest level. But yeah, being back on radio is like a part of me is fulfilled. And was that the dream from the outset? Was, you know, being that announcer, having that voice, having the proximity effect into the microphone and the headphones, that I don't think people realize how much of a dream that is for some people.
Yeah, well, in the 80s, it was the American, the Power FM, that kind of sound, right? Where they just sounded so cool when the Americans presented a record and then you had to do it in Danish, like, "Here come a Beyonce med nyeste single." I said something in Danish in a strange way.
I'm guessing it's related to Beyonce. But yeah,
they've got
power voices. They've got all the effects on. They've got their radio sound.
Exactly. We all want it to sound like that. But then when you work with music and you broadcast yourself, it just basically builds. And I love TV as well. It's you don't have that sound or that visual barrier. You can do something in TV, and there's a lot of things you can do in TV. But it I mean, you know how it is. Once you get into it, people get interested. And I think I peaked around like the millennium, the year 2000. I hosted the Grammys with someone called Casper here. And after that, I just, no more. I don't like this publicity.
What?
So I started, sorry?
What didn't you like about it? So look, we are talking about, on a national level, we're talking legitimately about fame, you getting stopped on boats for people to want to speak to you. It would have been selfies if cameras, but back then, you know, they had to set up the guy with the tripod and, you know, the single flash bulb and the guy that puts the hood over. So it was a whole big process then. But we're talking about, like, you know, genuine celebrity. Like, at first, how do you deal with that level of attention? And then you get to the point where you go, well, I just don't want it anymore. How long does it take to dissipate? That's interesting.
Well, I was the kind of type who, when people are like, you're an idiot, just for no apparent reason, that's how people react to famous people, apparently. I would always take, like, the debate. Why do you mean that? What do you base that on?
In the street.
I mean, and that, yeah. And, you know, you don't get far with that. Well, usually you get into very good conversations because 99% of all people are really nice people when it comes down to it. But just having to deal with that, I just hated it, basically.
And in the street, so people would come up in the street and go, you're an idiot, you blonde-tipped loser.
I remember once I went to, we have sort of like, you know, Roskilde Festival here. You have festivals in England as well, Glastonbury kind of stuff. We have one in Jylland called Smokefest, Beautiful Fest. I remember I was there with one of my friends and I just entered like the public area and then and half a chicken landed in my face, right? And this is what you have to deal with. And then someone just saw me felt like I should have his half a chicken in my face. And that is just how people are. And I just didn't want to deal with it. Also, Denmark is a small country, only 5-6 million people here. So even if you're like the most famous here, you can't make a living of that. You only pay the price for being famous. So if I was in the UK and being famous, that would be a different story because then you could basically embrace it and go like, well, I pay the price, but at least I get paid for it.
I think it was Luke Goss was talking about being part of the Bros, the band Bros.
Are we talking about Bros?
Yeah.
My idols.
When will I be famous?
Exactly.
And they lost all their money. And so he was famous and skint, so the worst possible combination. So Steve, it's not, I think you're wise to have lurked in the background. Obviously, you've worked with your fair share of Christians. What was your TV work? Because you've spent time in America doing TV stuff.
Yeah, that was making music documentaries through the early part of the 80s, but primarily for sale back here in Australia.
So you got a lot of crossover with Christians. So you had to deal with like some young blonde-tipped idiot to be your talent.
Yes. Prior to going to America, I had made a lot of youth music programs or music/comedy programs that were shown here. English viewers older viewers will remember Kenny Everett Show. Well, Kenny Everett Show was kind of where we got our inspiration from. You know, it was crazy comedy. Animation bits and bands and then I did a country music series, and then on top of that we did kids programs and magazine programs and I mean just about anything, you know. At the ABC prior to that I'd done documentaries and drama, and then went to America in the early 80s and made these music documentaries. Came back to Australia in the mid 80s and got involved in the advertising agency world.
Ah, that's interesting.
Making commercials, yeah.
And advertising, my family in parts unknown, not too far from you actually, into advertising, and seeing that world where it's a lot more campaign based, you will see the project through from conception to delivery in a much shorter time frame and see that creative process kind of unfold in a more dramatic way. And I suppose a lot of those adverts have room to not be perfect and room to fail in a way that, say, a movie might not. So that the quality varies a lot on adverts is what I'm trying to say.
It depends totally on the budget. You know, I've spent $500,000 making one television commercial. That's a shitload of money. Oh, excuse me, that's a bucket load of money. But I've also I've also made television commercials for, you know, a few thousand. It depends on, you know, what the client has, what the situation is. That's part of what intrigued me about that whole thing was how you had to be able to be incredibly versatile, you know, and be able to move with, you know, with the flow. I mean, I've got to say that it didn't take me long to get fed up with advertising agencies per se. You know, that's 99% BS and not a lot of creativity. So
right.
I got out of there fairly quickly and set up my own production company.
I was going to say, does that feel fairly soulless sometimes? Like that is price work, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it is fairly soulless, I've got to say.
During COVID, when all my stuff just collapsed and I thought I was going to have to go back to engineering, and I then found this Tapped In market where it was advertising stuff, basically. So real estate in the Middle East. Are you looking for your house in Diriyah? Come on, blah, blah, blah. And also, I think I was the voice of Stevenage Steel for a little while. And all that kind of price work, you know, you pick it up and put it down almost in a day. And things like language learning, the cat says, meow, you need to go to the doctors. That'll be £1,000, please. It was for America. And so that kind of price work, Steve, like the passion, it isn't always necessarily there.
No, but if you're trying to do a good job, you know, there's a certain amount of pride and passion, you know, that is always there. And yeah. I like to pride myself that, you know, everything I tried to do to the absolute, you know, best of my ability and make it work, you know, artistically and from the point of view of generating a result for the client. Now, I'm probably deluding myself somewhat with that statement. I'm sure there are, you know, well, I know there are projects that, you know, by the end of them, I wanted to be out of there as fast as I possibly could. But that's just, you know, life. And that's everyone's life. You have days like that.
But now you have the flexibility of your own production company, which is good because that means we get to have you on board as well.
Yeah, I mean, getting to my age, I'm winding that down a bit now. You know, I'm trying to take it a little bit easy. I've had enough with arguing with people about, you know, arguing with clients about one thing or another.
About what they think they want and what they told you what they wanted.
You see, that's a whole different ballgame. Yeah, and most clients don't know what they want. And, you know, the first job that you go through in that situation is trying to get them to understand, you know, to realize what they want. And that's the first thing. You're not just reacting to them. You've got to make certain they actually understand what they want. So yeah. You've got to, you know, research it and drive them to the point where finally they will give you a brief that is achievable and realistic.
And this is what
I'll be happy with.
I love speaking to these guys and why I'm glad we've had the space to do the meet the panel stuff over the winter. So you kind of get an idea of when Steve's talking about the broadcast, he's got that hands-on experience of having had to deal with, you know, people and having to deal with clients and deliver that product. When Christian is talking about some of the stuff on the broadcast, Christian knows what it's like to have the camera in your face and have it say, you know, let's go live. Is that what you prefer, Christian? If I could give you, I said this to Brad, I said infinite money, but with you, it's infinite contacts. What are you doing with your world? Are you live in front of a camera?
I'll tell you why I'm doing this with you. First of all, because I like you guys and I think you're doing it the right way and stuff. But it's also to get sometimes just a sense of being live. That is something you will, that is addictive. That is like going on stage performing or something like that. The feeling of live is just awesome. And I've done the most... And I'm going to almost use the S word as Steve did earlier. I'm not going to say it, but people know which word it is, shows during my lifetime, only to get like that live vibe because it makes me feel alive. I can't describe it in another way.
Yeah, I'm totally with Christian. There is nothing, there's no drug better in the world than doing live media, live television programs. It is just the best thing. And if I had my choice about what I was going to do for the rest of my life, it'd be doing live TV. And that's, you know, but the reason I enjoy working with Mist Apex, because of that live feel that is there.
And we're saying all this on a pre-record. But
that's, I know. But okay.
that's just because...
It feels live.
Sundays, obviously, are all taken up by Mist Apex. So over the winter, the pre-records just give a little bit of family time on the weekends. So that's one thing. But it's so weird, Christian, as a presenter, you'll probably get this. On a live, I will pretty much nail it every time. Yeah, and on radio, I don't fluff my intro on the radio. I'm straight in there. I do the show. If you give me a prereq, 10, 20 attempts, and
exactly,
I don't know what it is. There's something
same
about,
with me.
There's something about that live, you know the mic is live, the red light is on, that just tightens everything up. You're in the clutch.
I think that is basically the essence of what we're talking about here, because you use another part of your brain when you do live than if you do pre-record. It's like what controls your mouth is you when you know you can't undo it.
There's no edit,
Yeah, that's just, it's another way of broadcasting yourself, basically. And I think what you're using when you do that is it's a combination of pressure and expectations and everyone's looking at me and I have to perform and also have to say the right parts. All those things combined is a drug.
Yeah, so we're doing a mix of it now because I'm also a producer, so I really enjoy the production side. When we do these pre-records, I will spend hours, and once I recognize, I can change Christian's voice slightly, I will then spend the hour to change that, to get rid of, say, some room noise or something. And I'm sure, Steve, you're the same. As soon as you go, but this would look better if that background had, I don't know, a different luminosity, I will spend the 45 minutes to go through and fix that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've done it plenty of times. Don't you worry.
But when it's live, there's a, we got it. It's that, I don't know why your brain is more accepting, because you know you've set it in stone, you've set it in motion, and that's what you've got, I guess.
Yeah, the secret to good live is good planning. You plan the shit out of it, and then you do it live.
Yeah, so that you don't, if you have some grumpy old Australian swearing. Do you know what? Jono did it as well. So I think it's culturally insensitive to beep out Australian swearing. So from now on, we have to leave that in.
If that's maybe the worst that we say, I wouldn't be worried.
So I'll put the question to you then, Christian. In fact, because you've done so much, to me, the most interesting thing is being the almost teen pop sensation in the TV series How I Met Your Mother, when it's revealed that Robin had a secret past as a Canadian pop star. That's how I felt about you when I found out about all this, TV stuff. It was like, no way. So, but from that, then you're, superstar DJ, you've done racing, you've done directing, production. What is that area? What of those things has made you go, yeah, that's me. That's where I feel like I'm in the right place at the right time.
I think the answer would have to be what I'm doing now, right? I mean, as we all know, with age, we tend to turn down or just do less of what we don't like and more of what we like. And currently, I'm actually going back to making music. I will release my own music this year. Actually, it will be up today or a week from today or something like that. Els Krede from Pulse, which was my nickname in the media back then, right? And then I just finished a documentary about a Japanese-Danish fashion design studio, which actually helped save the black alpaca in Peru from extinction through their fashion products. And I've directed that documentary.
You couldn't think of any original ideas. You had to go with that tired old Danish-Japanese alpaca trope. You had to retread that path.
And then I'm going to start sim racing as soon as Fnatic gives me a wheel.
Wait,
that's
stop.
All.
A, excellent. I'm looking forward to you joining in with the Mist Apex iRacing. Entry links in the show notes below. What racing have you done then? Because Danes are generally, you're too big for racing normally.
You mean real life racing or sim racing?
Yeah, well, I class them all together.
Real racing, I used to have my own card, but I've done a lot of racing on TV. They did a show, I think I've been on it like 6 times, called Djævle Race back in the days, and Fifth Gear and stuff like that, where you race with other celebrities. I learned so much from being on that show, because you drive in rallycross cars, in dirt tracks, and then tarmac, and the cars are ruined, and you have crazy celebrities driving into you and stuff like that. So that was I'm going to tell one thing I've never said before, and this is Formula One related. Nicolas Kiese, who used to drive for Jordan, right? He was one of the guys teaching us how to drive on one of the shows. And how to qualify for the race, you had to go get into your car with your partner. You were always driving with a partner. And then you set off, and then 10 seconds later, Nicholas would start in his own car. He had a bigger car. He'd driven the track numerous times. I'd never driven the car, never driven the track, and he couldn't catch me. Damn straight, and he's going to deny it. But then they had to redo it because they forgot to give me the safety harness on for the neck, and I hate that. So it was never shown to anyone.
Well, we're going to have to explore that. We're going to out him. We're going to see if we can get a confession. So I love the trope of the 90s TV star coming out with a new... Is it going to be a hit record or is it aimed at like
TV kids? No, you're not going to like it. It's strange, soundtrack-ish, electronic, ambient, dark ambient, very, very moody music.
I want it. I want it, and I want it to be I want you to... Anything that ends up on the cutting room floor, we'll use it for outros and bumpers. And Steve, finally from you, a thank you from me live here is that you took the Missed Apex video, you looked at it, you messaged me, you called me a moron, and you dragged us to a level of professionalism, which I think when other people have found us, they've gone, how are these guys set up with a set and a green screen and lighting and we can see it? And this is at a point where, you know, a lot of YouTube stuff was harder and that sort of set us apart a little bit. I feel like part of it was I was so bad that I annoyed you enough to fix it. And for that, I thank you and apologize.
That's all right. I'll do it again next week too.
No, that was an ongoing thing. He does do it every week. So Steve, from a career point of view, obviously 69 is like a normal, completely normal retirement kind of age. But you look at people like you, like me, like my wife, you know, people who are creative and freelance, there's never really that retire button. Because your passion is video production work, you're probably going to keep doing it until a higher power decides otherwise.
Well, if I had my druthers now, I'd find out a way to get rid of the tinnitus that I have in my ears. That gives me, you know, I have very bad noise in my ears. And I'd go back to, I've been a musician all my life. I got into video through music. I wanted to be an audio producer. I've played in bands all my life. I've made 8 CDs, written, you know, all the stuff, played most of the instruments on them. So I'd go back to, if I could get clear my ears up, I'd go back to doing music again in my dotage.
We're going to find some footage. I know you've sent me some footage of you playing guitar. I'm pretty sure I've got it. I'll see if I can dig that up. Steve, Amy, thank you so much. You lurk in our Slack chat. That's the only place you can find you on social media. And
that's right.
As always, we'll give out Christian Pedersen's home address and we'll link to some 90s TV. Thank you very much to the crew. I hope you've enjoyed us talking about F1 broadcasting. Until we see you next, work hard, be kind, and have fun. This was Missed Apex Podcast.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.